Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Politics. I'm Tim Jones, and my guests today are Robert Holtzman and Fernando Restoy, co-editors of Central Banks and Supervisory Architecture in Europe, Lessons from Crises in the 21st Century, published by Edward Elgar. The European economy and financial sector have been stress-tested by pandemic and war, but compared to the period between 2007 and 2012, the experience has been remarkably stable. The recapitalized banks have held up well, so by and large has the quality of their assets, despite 10 years of slow growth and low inflation, followed by enormous volatility, high inflation, and interest rates heading to two-decade highs. How much of this has been luck, and how much due to the rethinking and redesign of the European banking supervision after the searing experience of financial and debt crises? And what still has to be done? To answer these questions, Robert Holtzman and Fernando Restoy have pulled together 20 contributors from central banking and the academy. Since 2019, Robert Holtzman has been governor of the Austrian National Bank and his country's representative on the European Central Bank's Governing Council. Formerly an economist at the OECD, the IMF and the World Bank, Professor Holtzman has taught economics full-time in Vienna and Saarland and as a visiting scholar at Harvard and Oxford. Since 2017, Fernando Restoy has chaired the Financial Stability Institute at the Bank for International Settlements in Basel. Trained at the LSE and Harvard, Dr. Restoy joined the Bank of Spain in 1991 and rose to the position of Deputy Governor, Chairman of Spain's Crisis Resolution Authority, the FROB, and a member of the Supervisory Board of the ECB's Single Supervisory Mechanism. Welcome, both of you, to the podcast. My first question really is the first four words of your joint introduction are, why this book now? When did you decide to put it together and how did you choose your contributors?
If I may start out, it came about that when I joined the Austrian National Bank, there was a discussion whether the Austrian National Bank should relinquish its remaining competence on supervision to a special body, the Financial Market Authority, or not. And as I had to acquaint myself with the arguments, I looked around and found many different alternatives, arguments pro and against certain aspects of content as well as structure. And so I told my staff, I think it would be important to have a conference because there are topics there which don't have simple answers, as always in economics, but here specifically. And the second part, of course, is that to acquaint myself with the key specialists in this area. So we organized a conference at the Austrian National Banker, invited many people, and then once the conference was over, we said, oh gosh, we have so many interesting papers there. Not all the topics are covered. Perhaps if and as we invite the one or other person, we would have a greater conference volume, which would really be the first one which tries to bring together the different thinking, not yet a common story out them. And so after the conference, then I called up Fernando Restoy and asked him, you know much more than I do about it. So would you want to be willing to come along? I can cover some of the more monetary and central bank thinking. You are the specialist is in area. And he said, yes. And after 1.5 years of hard work, the conference volume came out.
Yeah, if I may, first, good morning to everyone and congrats for this opportunity. Yes, I think Robert described very well the process. It was his idea, actually, just to put together this volume after the conference that the Austrian National Bank organized, I think it was at the end of 2019. And then, well, of course, we started discussing what type of people could actually be invited to participate in this volume. I think we came out with the idea that probably we will need a good combination of people who will actually have the background, some policy experience, as well as some strong academic background, so they were able to put together theory and practice. And we were very happy, actually, to have the possibility to put together so many brilliant, actually, authors, and we're very happy with the end result of this book.
Yes, I was thinking that when I was reading it, that you really do have a cross section. How long did it take you to corral all these people to bring them to the conference?
I think the conference itself, which took place in 2019, it was not too difficult. And this is the beauty of Vienna and of the National Banker. Many people like to come to Vienna, as you know, may know the most desirable place to live in the world, at least according to some magazines. And we are renowned to have good conferences, treat the people well. But still, as always, you know, you have to tell them how important it is that they are there. And it then took some time to add a few more. And then also they're all busy people, so to control them to deliver on time. So it was not too much work, but it was still work. And I think at the end of the day, everybody enjoyed.
Well, I'd like to come to a central question, a recurring question throughout the book, is whether and how to separate the core function of the modern central bank, maintaining price stability and financial stability through micro and macro prudential policies. Where did both of you end up after reading the chapters and after the conference compared to where you were before?
If again, I can start out on this side, because this is how to say where the central bank still is challenged from many directions. So even after reading this, after having that, I have a clear understanding, but I'm still not sure how best to do it. My thinking at the end of the day is, if I look now what happens at the ESRB, European Systemic Risk Board, where we have different participants, not only from the euro area, but also from the outside, there are many ways in order to organize it, what is lies the cat. So at the end of the day, what matters is that one has a kind of an integrating instrument like the ESRB board, which helps out there, where it is settled at the central banker, and how much it is outside has nowadays, in my view, a secondary importance. This may be a specificity of the euro area. This may not be applicable to the world outside, and Fernando knows much more about what happens outside, what it means. For me, there's still the big question which is above this or is linked with it. This is the role of central bank for financial stability, this is something which I think we will discuss throughout here. Who is responsible for that? Because what we have is actually that we have the price stability in our constitution, ECB constitution, but financial stability actually came in from the side, is not extra there, but quite definitely we need to work on it, and we have to take this into account. So at the time being, I don't think that the institutional separation is what matters, but to have a mechanism which helps that you have and a joint assessment of it, and then make sure how to say you take the right action. Who does it, in my view, has less of an importance.
Yeah, if I may add something here, of course, this is an issue we have been discussing over the course of the preparation of the volume, Governor Holtzman and myself, also looking at the contributions of the different authors. I mean, my own personal sort of conclusion after going over those issues already for some time is that there is already an emerging consensus that, of course, these two functions, so economic or monetary stability and financial stability, are inherently interrelated. I think nobody could actually question that. Very hard actually to get economic stability without financial stability on the other way around. So that certainly implies that you cannot separate too much actually those two functions. You cannot just basically say that I'm going to assign one particular function to one particular agency without one particular instrument, and you will have actually the same for the other objective to another different agency with different instruments, right? So things are much more complex than that. Of course, there could be different institutional arrangements, as Robert was saying, in which that type of interrelation could be fully actually acknowledged and recognized. My personal view, if you ask me, is that indeed I think it's a good idea to have central banks with financial stability responsibilities, and more concretely with macro and micro prudential responsibilities. But I fully agree that there could be other arrangements involving more agencies. But as Robert was saying, it's important actually that in that case, you have sufficient coordination. There are important efforts to get common understanding on the policy needs, actually, in terms of both monetary and financial stability. If this coordination happens with two separated agencies, fine. Otherwise, of course, you will have to rely on a single agency, being able actually to internalize all the synergies and interrelations between the two objectives.
Yeah, in his chapter, Paul Tucker looks into this argument of the argument of an ultimate goal for central banks being what he calls monetary system stability. And this ties into what you were both just saying. I was reminded of a real-world example of this in 2012 with the ECB's famous whatever it takes argument, where the ECB's central mandate was perceived to be keeping inflation a little under 2%. But ultimately, that mandate meant preserving the currency, because without that, you know, everything else changes. What did you make of his argument for this monetary system stability mandate? Is it doable?
Well, my sense is we actually have it now, because my take is that it's difficult to have financial stability without price stability, or to have price stability without financial stability. So even if we don't have a mandate, it's our own interest to make sure, and this is what I understand also from Paul's writing, and he said monetary system stability, that it covers both parts of it. The question is only when it comes to system stability, the broader part of it, what are our instruments to use? In some cases, to say we can only control, or in many cases only control, we have other partners there which influence the financial system stability. And a typical example, what I currently see, sir, has to do with the application of monetary instruments at the moment, where we have to take account of what does it do about the financial system stability. Example, quantitative easing. We have decided that we want to start with quantitative easing as of March this year. But we start small, and the reason is that we would like to have a faster reduction of our balance sheet, but we are not sure whether the financial system is stable enough maybe there will be some hiccups, as we had it in the UK recently, in order to disrupt the process. But there's very little what we can do in many cases in order to assure it. Quite often we don't have even information. So we do it slowly to gain experience, and then we'll increase it as time goes on. So it shows that in our application of a policy, we are, how to say, hampered by that, but on the other hand, how to say, we take account of that, where in reality there are other institutions which influence it, even if they can't do anything in specific to do it. So my take is it's our own interest to make sure financial stability takes place, but we don't have always the instrument to be the master of this universe. So we have to make compromises and we have to be careful.
Yeah. Actually, can I have a follow-up on that, which is something that may have worked in the opposite direction when, during the middle of the pandemic crisis, one of the instruments you used to ease policy was softening the terms of the three-year loans. And this ended up at this stage, as you're trying to tighten policy, the financial stability issue and monetary policy started to work against each other. Would you see that perhaps as an example of where having the two mandates within the same house became a problem?
If I may on this, frankly, Tim, I'm not sure that the pandemic was a good example of trying possible frictions between different actually objectives. I think I would stress basically the opposite. What happened over the pandemic, certainly almost after the pandemic outbreak, immediately after the pandemic outbreaks in March, April, 2020, what happened there is that there was a sort of almost spontaneous convergence of views of different policymakers in different policy domains. At that time, you had actually, of course, fiscal policymakers relaxing fiscal policy dramatically in order actually just to try to compensate the shock that the particular lockdowns would have had on income. There was actually monetary policy makers, of course, they adopted quite an accommodative policy stance, relaxing even more the already accommodative policy stance they had before. You had macro prudential authorities actually sort of releasing the countercyclical capital buffer, so again, adopting expansion in macro prudential policies. And importantly, micro prudential guys actually even relaxing supervisory standards, giving priority to the continuation of credit flows to the real economy basically trying just to protect banks from, you know, the shocks that would have to suffer. So it was a sort of a connection, even a spontaneous coordination, if you want, across policymakers for all of them to try actually to preserve both economic and financial stability. If I may, just going back also to the other example you pointed out before, which is the famous whatever it takes sentence by Mario Draghi. Actually, it is often forgotten that what Draghi said is not only we will do whatever it takes to preserve the euro, blah, 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 but he added within our mandate. And indeed, and this was often forgotten when people refer to that particular episode. And this is important because I think the philosophy behind ECB's actions at that time and afterwards as well was that whatever they do in terms of, for instance, trying to mitigate unwarranted interest rate differentials in parity markets, whatever they do in that domain, it has to do basically to try to preserve the adequate functioning of the monetary transmission mechanism. At the time, Mario Draghi actually expressed his famous sentence, was a time in which there was huge redenomination risk in European capital markets, and that was impairing dramatically the monetary transmission mechanism, and the ECB could not do a good job in that circumstances. So it could well actually understand actually the ECB's actions and Mario Draghi's sentence as something which is pretty much in line with the mandate of the ECB. The only thing they did, of course, is to interpret it, and rightly so, in a relatively broad way. But there was, frankly, it is not necessarily to think that that the ECB was stretching its mandate. I mean, you could classify very well what they did at that time, and they have continued doing that to some extent more recently. Has to do with the core mandate in terms of protecting actually adequate monetary policy making, the adequate functioning of the monetary transmission mechanism.
Yeah, actually, your discussion there of stretching the mandate brings us on to a very interesting theme that's covered in two of the chapters by Ignazio Angeloni and David Archer, where they talk about this idea of actually establishing what they call, quote, explicit emergency mandates, so that you don't have, that it's clear to people in advance how a central bank would react in an emergency. Where do you both stand on this after the conference and the book?
I have to say, at the conference and even now, I'm a bit skeptical about it. And the reason is that from a conceptual point of view, it sounds pretty neat. You know, you have two states of the world, a normal one, an exceptional one, and of course you should have different instruments there. But in reality, you know, in the middle of something, first of all, when do you call it saying now we're exceptional? And the second part is how do you define it ex ante? And each crisis is different, even if economically, how does it something to do? So my take is, yes, one could make conceptually the pointer, but from the point of view of implementability, I would have my great doubts that this to work. And from what we have seen during the recent crisis, that's the only one I have got to know so far as a central banker, I don't think there was a need for that. How to say, we didn't stretch our mandate by doing what we did.
Well, actually, can I come back to you on that? Because you were there at the time when the pandemic emergency purchase program was initiated in spring 2020. You did have an instrument available to you in the form of the outright monetary transactions from 2012, but you went for this much bigger, more symmetrical program. Did you have any hesitation at the time that this might be exceeding your mandate? Were you comfortable? Would you, in any way, be more comfortable with an explicit mandate?
Frankly speaking, we never had a real discussion about that, because when we had the pandemic and come February, March, what we saw was a dramatic fall in demand. And so we knew we had to do something bigger. And if you recall, we had come forward with a relatively small sum first, 120 billion, and the market shrugged it off, not sufficient. So we had to come up with our 750, and the market said, okay, that's it, that's credible. So we didn't have time to think even about whether we would exceed it. And we didn't have the feeling that we exceeded. We were there working within the mandate to make sure that this demand fallout doesn't lead to something which at this time was still highly probable, that it would have deflationary development. So we did what we needed to do. And even nowadays, I think we are confident we did the right thing.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Restore, how do you feel on the explicit mandate point?
Explicit mandate, that you mean the issue about the, you know, the need?
Yeah, an emergency mandate, yes. Actually having something in advance so that all economic actors know where the central bank stands. Yeah,
you are right that there are a few authors who really actually stress this point. Also, and as you said before, actually, there are a couple of chapters and we touch up on this particular matter. Well, it depends very much. I think for this particular issue, probably you cannot actually sort of establish a general doctrine. It depends very much, actually, on the sort of democratic culture in different jurisdictions. In some cases, actually, central banks have a broad mandate. There is a trust, actually, they are going to use it in a sensible way in order to protect social policy goals like economic, monetary, price stability. In other cases, actually, the checks and balances operate in a different way, so that you basically need to work on providing legitimacy to central bank actions in different situations. In this latter case, which is probably the one in which the one which had David, both David Archer and Tucker had in mind, well, could make sense, actually, some sort of provision in the central bank's statute that in, you know, particular circumstances, they could somewhat modify some of their tools in order to achieve their social policy goals without needing to request actually explicit authorization at that time, but relying on some sort of exposed accountability. Frankly, I think very much, this depends very much actually what are the traditions, the cultural traditions, that then, you know, how, what is actually the type of the stringency of the parliamentary controls or central bank actions that you could observe in different jurisdictions. Depending on that, you may need actually to go for one or another institutional arrangements.
Yes, actually, on that point, as you say, both Charles Bean and Paul Tucker talk about this idea of political accountability, which becomes more important after emergency situations. But in the experience of both of you, and you have a lot of experience of internationally and in your domestic political field, can you give me examples of where you feel that parliaments or congresses have held a central bank effectively to account? Because it does require a combination of highly technical ability and political nous. Are there examples of this? Because I've never seen one.
Well, I have to say, I was just preparing this morning with my staffer an intervention at Austrian Parliament, who was requested to come into that. It's not the first time. The typical part is, clearly, we have our inflation mandate, so we reacted during the crisis. Now the question is, we have the inflation. The question is, do we do the right thing? So going up there, of course, questions come, should we have acted earlier? A good question, which I have answered differently in the past, perhaps to some of my colleagues there. But at the end of the day is, are we able to live up to our mandate, which is price stability? And here then explaining why, for whatever reasons, this can happen, this cannot happen. Exposed, one is always, of course, more informed what may have happened. But this kind of accountability where the sovereign calls up the governor and the vice governor by law, going there, explaining, and getting tough questions. This is how the process is, and this is how it should be. And for me, this has never created an issue. And for my colleagues, some get tougher questions, others get left pass questions. But in all cases, you have this regular discussions with the parliamentarian, sometimes outside of it, in order to explain what we are doing. You want to get your buy-in, but also, how to say, here says something critique and explaining where they may be right, they may not be right. And this is the way how I take my responsibility as a governor, but also my responsibility to explain to the sovereign our work.
And in Spain, did you have the same experience, Dr.?
Yes, absolutely. Of course, when you are a member of the Eurozone, as happens to Austria and Spain, accountability is not much on actual monetary policy actions. It is normally the Spanish Parliament is about actually actions taken in other domains that at the time I was a deputy governor were still under responsibility of the Bank of Spain, talking about crisis resolution or even banking supervision. But I think in general, people understand accountability not as, eventually the governor or central bank going to the parliament and sort of receiving instructions from elected officials. I think it's a different thing. I mean, accountability should be understood as, I think Paul Tucker put it very, very nicely, at least part of the you would call it constitution, right? The money credit constitution. He calls. So you have actually so first delegated objectives, delegated functions. You have a number of instruments that you can use in order to achieve those delegated objectives, and then you have the accountability regime, right? So accountability is basically to that you should prove that you are delivering on the objectives that you have been delegated to. So and then whenever now, for instance, a good situation, a very useful example to see that of course central banks have to go to their parliaments and to explain why inflation is so high. I mean, how comes that despite having a central bank with a price stability mandate, inflation is whatever, 8-9%. So, and then you have actually the governors going to the parliaments. They all go, they are all going now to the parliaments explaining what they are doing, what are the causes of inflation, why monetary policy is not actually able to deliver lower inflation in the very short term, and you know, emphasizing that the way the care is about actually inflation expectations over the medium term. They are now doing what they are doing in order to anchor inflation expectations. So providing all those explanations to elected officials and the public at large, to people, as Robert was saying, for people to understand what the central bank is doing and the type of objectives they are trying to achieve. And frankly, this is working well in general. Again, but then you have actually just to be clear that accountability does not mean that the European Parliament could actually provide you with specific instructions, what you should do or you should not do. Accountability is about you explain what you have done, how you have tried to achieve your mandate, and to explain what are the sources or deviations from your mandate.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, moving on to another issue, but a fundamental issue in Europe. This is covered in their chapters by Torsten Beck, but also by Francesco Paolo Mongeli, Christopher Koch, and Karin Hobelsberger. They look at the unfinished business of the deep reforms that have happened in the Eurozone since the crisis 10 plus years ago. The chief among these are the failure to break the doom loop between the sovereigns and their local banks, and the continued national fragmentation of single market in banking. And that one, that's been going on as long as I can remember. Why do you feel this has been so hard to crack for so long?
Fernando, if you could start out, since you have the long experience, and then I come in with my experience, is much shorter.
Well, I mean, you have this, the banking union has, I mean, you want to simplify actually the objectives of the banking union, I could just say that this is about trying to denationalize banks' risk. So we are halfway, actually, in trying to achieve that objective. It's great. We have a single supervisory mechanism. It's great that we have a single resolution mechanism together with a single resolution fund. But it's not enough. I mean, basically, we need to work on deposit protection. And we don't currently have an European deposit insurance scheme. And without that, of course, you have not fully achieved the objective of denationalizing a bank's risk. Why we have not made more progress on this? Well, it's politically very complicated. It's about another source of mutualization of risks, which is not an idea which is not particularly appreciated in in some jurisdictions, sometimes with very good reasons. Particular people understand there could be, it makes very little sense to work on denationalizing, say, the liability part of bank's balance sheet, deposits, but not doing something similar on the asset side. And of course, people have in mind the excessive domestic bias or sovereign portfolio by commercial banks. And on that basis, they are proposing actually just establish some sort of regulatory penalties for excessive concentration of sovereign holdings on the domestic sovereign. So that obviously triggers a very difficult political discussion. And frankly speaking, it's a big failure of the European Union that we have not been able actually just to deliver on the officially declared third pillar of the banking union, which is an European deposit insurance scheme. Yeah, so far, it's not in the agenda, unfortunately, of the ministers. I hope very much it's going to come back to the agenda soon, but it's not yet the case. But what is, in any case, important to bear in mind, if I may just expand a little bit more on this, is that even we had a fully fledged banking union, you will not expect, you should not expect to have overnight a optimal integration of the banking market in Europe. So integration implies basically to have more pan-European banks. So banks operating in several European jurisdictions. This is not going to happen now. This is not happening now. This is not going to happen either, probably even if you had fully fledged banking union. And the reason being is that at present, there is no business case for banks to operate in other European jurisdictions. And this has to do very much with the structure of the banking industry in Europe, and in particular with the overcapacity of the banking industry. Simply, there is no business case actually for banks to operate in other jurisdictions because it's going to be extremely hard for them to compete in those jurisdictions, because sometimes it's very difficult even actually to acquire banks in other jurisdictions, for instance, if they are under cooperative or saving banks type of a statute. So all those structural obstacles are the ones which are probably more relevant to explain why we don't have sufficient European banking integration.
And the experience for you, Governor Holtzman?
Well, I agree with what Fernando has said. I would add two aspects, sir. Number one is that we have already an increasing share of people that take deposits outside and do this because they see that the rates of return they receive there is higher than they would have at home. The way how this bank does it is often through a business model which is less sustainable than otherwise. If it has, then the bank gets bankrupt, then the deposit insurance of the country, the bank is there, has to pay the foreigners there. And this is something which is one of the many side effects of things which are not fully thought through. And to build in a stronger risk factor into this incentive system is politically so far not possible. And I'm talking now of particular of the Austrian experience. We had these cases where banks could use a highly risky business model, but at the end of the day, those who use this banker cannot only reimburse, they can also run away with the non-sustainable interest rate. So what we have there are numbers still of things sought through which are not consistent. The other part is that we've also not solved the problems in countries, and so it's political between countries, where banks have a great interest, but also because of great incentives of the political loop to take on government assets. Fernando referred to it. In principle, there should be some kind of disincentives there, which are so far too little and could be increased. And the result, some countries with a huge financing demand finance most of their financing needs domestically. They don't want to go outside because they would have to pay higher rates then. And at the end of the day, leads to that the banking connex nexus is not solved. And unless we have, economic instruments to change these incentives, but also countries with huge debts rely on this kind of financing. Some countries like Austria have little incentives to join this deposit insurance because they're very much afraid they would have to bail out others, and this is something which is politically impossible. So at the end of the day, it's technical and it's political, and then both sides, the technical side has not been solved to say, has the political been reduced or not, or does it still stay on?
Well, as a final question, I'd like to ask you both about the chapter by Daniel Hardy, in which he assesses the role of the central bank in climate change. This has been a core message of Christine Lagarde at the ECB, but Jay Powell at the Federal Reserve takes a much more constrained view of his mandate. Do you see dangers in moving the central bank into this area?
Since here, that's something what we discuss at the Austrian National Bank level, but also at board level, and we all have slightly different views on this. My take is, give you my personal one, is the climate risk is so big that we cannot ignore it as a central banker, and so it has to be high on our attention side to deal with it. The question is the level of the involvement. Where, in what area should the bank be involved? Is it that it has to do with the way one can influence the investment in green assets than in less green assets, green, brown assets? Well, this could be one way, but the problem is, and what I've seen there, again, with local examples there, that a brown industry raising money, they essentially do it in order to become greener. So if you give a penalty there, then it is not the best interest there. And what we've seen more recently, what is brown, what is green, depends very much on the capacity of washing it. And so, yes, sir, we have to take account of it. We should do our best of it, but we have to be very careful in order to make it happen. And here things differ. I mean, what I've heard from Jay Powell is, you know, it is not our primary date. I would echo the same thing there. But I would say we have to look into that and might take it and use now my own national bank there. I think I see a lot of inconsistent messages coming out from the different demand there, micro, macro, whatever it is. I think a central banker has a major role because it's impacted through the inflation effect there, through the financial markets effect there. So we have a great interest in making sure that the solution to the climate change challenges is a good one. And so I say our role in providing and helping to channel, offering a discussion forum to come forward with a good solution, but not necessarily using our instruments in order to channel it, because from what they've seen from a technical point of view, this may be not the right support we could give.
Yeah, if I may on this, because I fully agree with what Robert said. I think it's obvious to everyone that the financial sector is deemed to play a crucial role to facilitate the transition towards a more sustainable economy, because they are the ones that should actually make it possible, a huge reallocation of resources that transition is going to require. So it could actually be argued that indeed central banks and supervisory organizations have a role to play in order to somewhat support, facilitate, at least not providing obstacles for this role, important role that the financial sector has to play. But I think it's important that we do all this within the current mandate of central banks and supervisory organizations. And there are a number of things that, that could and should be done. Certainly, this idea of incorporating climate-related risks in the assessment of collateral or counterparties in monetary policy operations, or trying actually just to promote the adequate assessment and management of climate-related financial risk by financial institutions themselves. This is something which is absolutely within the mandate of central banks and supervisory organizations. These type of actions could actually facilitate monetary and financial stability, and at the same time, providing the right incentives for banks actually just to adapt their investment policies in a direction which would be more compatible with sustainability. So that is fine. So the problem, and you talk about problems, yes, the problem arises when actually there you see already in some jurisdictions that whether explicitly or implicitly, central banks and supervisory organizations are asked to incorporate actually climate objectives within their mandates. So it's not only about actually sort to see how their mandates will actually speak in favor of adjusting some procedures which may actually be beneficial for sustainability. No, it's simply that you have to do something with a direct actually climate type of rationale. So this is a big mistake, I believe. In doing that, you will start generating some relevant policy trade-offs. That may also affect actually the independence of central banks, and all that could only lead actually to a suboptimal social outcome. So that's the risk that we are seeing some places in the world. Too much pressure on regulators, too much pressure on central banks actually to adopt directly climate-related objectives. I don't think this is the right approach.
Okay, well, to finish as usual, I've asked both my guests to recommend at least two books to listeners, often one from their field and a personal choice. What have you chosen? Should we go first with Dr. Ristoy?
Wow, that's a very, very difficult, right? So I decided not to be too original here. So I'm going to recommend two bestsellers with a completely different nature. First one is I like very much biographies, and I found the one by Barack Obama, I think it was published in 2020, absolutely amazing. It's a wonderful combination, a very wonderful description of number of important personal developments, how actually he was able actually to go through all this very, very difficult period of his life, and very interesting and challenging as well. But also I think it's an incredibly good insight on how American politics work and the role of pragmatism, how politics could actually be used in order to change things a little bit to the extent that you behave in a sufficiently pragmatic but also determined way. So I like very much this book. Second one is somewhat different, older. It's some of you have read it, I'm sure, but it's called The Lords of Finance by Liaquat Ahmed, I think 2014. This is an amazing book. If you are interested in central banking, central banks, money, and I think the experience of relevant central bankers in the interwar period, which is the period which is covering this book, is incredibly instructive and interesting. And also it's quite fun to read. So I will leave it there, those two recommendations.
Thank you. And Governor Holtzman?
I have selected three books, two from the same author who was already mentioned, which have to do with Paul Tucker. We all know his book, Unelected Power. I think it's something which asks particular governors to question themselves and to think through what they can do, whether they're overstepping it, and how this can be organized. And the other is the current one, which is currently touring to present, this Global Discourse, in which he tries to develop a framework in which nations can interact with each other economically in order not to reduce the economic basis of both groups of powers there, while, how to say, are staying within their values. And is also presenting it, Paul, coming Monday here in Vienna at the Austrian National Banker. So I'm looking forward to the discussion. I do not always agree with Paul, often not, but it makes me think, and this is this part what I appreciate. The other one is something which is so far only available in German, unfortunately, written in 2018 by Paul Münkler, and it deals with the War of 30 Years, which Dossier can describe as a European catastrophe and a German trauma. And the reason is not, Tato said, that this part, the part itself is interesting, how it is done. But for me, when I read it, I was struck by, how to say, the similarities which we see there about a conflict which started out small, which, how to say, gained almost the greatness of then European war, because at each turn, a new actor entered the table and led that the war dragged on for 30 years because it fought him. And I see a lot of the parallels currently what we have in the world, different conflicts which emerge, which are never, how to say, extinguished, which are dragging on. And this is something, if people can read it, is a warning in a situation what we currently have, which I would like to pass on.
Thank you. Well, five very interesting recommendations. Today I've been discussing central banks and supervisory architecture in Europe with its editors, Robert Holtzman and Fernando Restoy. Thank you both very much for coming on.
Our pleasure. Thanks a lot for having us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.